Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this afternoon's LSE event. My name is Harry Barkema. I'm professor of management here at the LSE, also the director of our social innovation lab. And it's my pleasure to welcome our special guest of today, also our speaker, Didi Nunelli. Didi is going to speak about a big question, if not one of the biggest questions in social innovation, how to scale up social innovation successfully. And it's a question that is both extremely interesting and extremely important. It's interesting, for instance, the field maybe now exists, say, 10 years, that has taken off. And from the beginning, there's been this big question, why do so few social enterprises scale up? And even now, today, 10 years later, there have been partial answers. But still, we haven't cracked completely why so few social innovations, so few social enterprises scale up. And obviously, it's an extremely important question as well, because whether you reach maybe 100 people, or you reach 1,000 people, or you reach 100,000, that obviously makes a huge difference for impact. So it's one of the big questions that we have in the field. And Didi is the perfect speaker on this topic. She has just written a wonderful, nice book about the topic scaling social innovation in Africa. I believe there's even a possibility to buy a couple of books after this. You don't mind me saying this, right? I have to say I've read it with pleasure. It's packed with very practical, lots of practical insights. And every budding social entrepreneur or early stage or even experienced can learn a lot from the practical insights and the wonderful examples in this booklet as well. It's only 130 pages, say, apart from Penny says, but it's packed, very readable book. So she's the perfect person to speak about this. Didi comes from Nigeria. Both parents were professors. I'm sure they're very proud that she went on to Wharton first to do her undergraduate, and then Harvard. Going on to found a couple of social enterprises herself, Leap, that will maybe come up, is there on the screen as well, but also moved into private equity. Founded a couple of initiatives in that domain, Sahel funding initiatives in agro processing, manufacturing, and so on. So she's a perfect speaker for today. Before I give the floor to Didi, I should still say that for Twitter users, the hashtag for today is @LSE Innovation. Please put your phones on silent. We're trying to make a recording of this so many people can share the wonderful things that Didi is going to say, but it's harder if you have your phones on it, so please kill the sound of your phones. The order of things of today is that Didi will speak maybe for 25, 30 minutes, whatever. After that, I'm supposed to ask a couple of questions. It's my pleasure to do so. And then we'll open up for the questions that you'll have. And usually it's a topic that a lot of people feel strongly about, social innovation. We probably have some experienced people in this room as well. Scaling is a huge topic. And so feel free to share your questions or share your pain in that domain or happy experiences with us as well. So without further ado, I would now like to give the floor to the...
can hold it. Thank you. Good afternoon or good evening. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you for your very kind introduction, and thanks to LSE for hosting. I'm really honored. So many friends and old classmates and childhood friends in the room. So that even makes me more nervous, because I spoke at Oxford this morning and I didn't know anybody in the room. So it's easier when you don't know anybody, because, you know, the bar is a bit lower. It's really a pleasure to be here. I have a short presentation and I'll run through it quickly. It just shares some of the highlights from the book, and then we'll take questions. So basically, I'll start off by explaining what my definition of social innovation is and the need for scaling, just so we're all on the same plane. And then we'll talk about some of the insights from the research I did for the book and some recommendations for stakeholders. So clearly, there are many, many definitions of social innovation. I picked the one that the Stanford Social Innovation Review uses, which is social innovation is a novel solution to social problems, where novel refers to something that is either an original idea or an adaptation of an existing idea because it's more efficient or sustainable. And social problems are defined as problems that affect majority of people. But a social innovation could be a movement, a product, a technology, a piece of legislation. It's not limited to a very limited idea of a social innovation. And you can see social innovations in the public sector, in the private sector, and civil society. So social innovations cut across all sectors. Now, what is scaling? There are also a lot of different approaches to scaling, depending on what is being scaled. And authorities in the field have basically define four approaches to scaling, depending on whether you're scaling a program, an idea, a technology, or a policy. Now, this is a very personal agenda for me, because I live in Lagos, and yesterday I almost missed my flight because it took me about 2.5 hours on the bridge, Third Mainland Bridge, which is the longest bridge in Africa. But it's also a very big problem in the continent, because we started off with 477 million people in 1980, today, 1.2 billion, and we're projected to be 2.4 billion. Now, Lagos, which has 20 million people, is projected to have 50 million by 2050, with infrastructure for 3. Now, that's why I spent 2.5 hours on a little bridge. At the earlier session today at Oxford, somebody brought up this incident that happened yesterday, which was very ghastly. A 7-year-old boy was burned to death for stealing Gary. Some of you might have heard of that. And a lot of people are upset, they're enraged. And I said, don't be upset. When you put millions of people in a little room like this, what happens? Chaos, right? People are hot, they're hungry, they're tired. And even though there are pockets of social innovations and a lot of great examples of people doing good work, they're only reaching hundreds or thousands. They're not reaching millions. So when we look at the continent and we look at issues around sanitation, and education and health. I mean, there's a crisis because we cannot meet the needs of the people that are in our neighborhood, not to talk about the people in the vast cities. 60% of our countries are urbanized. I mean, 60% of the population is now in urban communities. So you're having, you know, serious challenges around some of the most basic problems that affect us. So this is a personal agenda for me, and for anybody who's concerned with Africa, this is a huge challenge. Now, the methodology for doing the research was that I enrolled in a senior fellowship at the Harvard Kennedy School and launched an online tool. As the professor said, first asking people what is causing the challenge, what are the main challenges around scaling, what's preventing us from scaling, and then to try and say, okay, so who is doing it well, and who is scaling, and how are they doing it? And then I interviewed about 80 social innovators, funders, stakeholders. I couldn't put all their logos on here, but a vast majority of people. And finally, my two top leaders, Pamela Hardingen of the School Center at Oxford and Dr. Linz of Brookings. And Pamela Hardingen just passed away. Some of you might know her. She was the first executive director of the Schwab Foundation for Social Entrepreneurship, and that's how I met her. And she was my anchor when it came to writing this book. Also, I had started a range of social innovations, and he mentioned Leap Africa. So Leap Africa is about 14 years old, and when we started, I was challenged by the desire to change mindsets about what leadership meant. and the need to empower young people and business owners that they could be leaders of today and tomorrow, and they didn't have to wait for others to improve their society. LEAP has trained about 50,000 people, and we've basically measured that impact by the change projects these people have started, about 1,000 change projects in communities around the country. Now, you'd think we should be celebrating our impact, but in a country of 170 million, we've only reached 50,000. We've written 11 books, so our books go much further, but that's still not scale for me. Similarly, we started Ace Foods because of our conviction that 60% of our population engaged in agriculture should be processing for the local market. We have one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world, 37% of our children are stunted. So we started a company to take food sourced locally, processed locally for the local market. And we've reached 5,000 farmers, whoop-de-doo. But in a country where we have 17 million farmers, that's not impact. And so my desire was to say, how can I scale? Why am I not scaling? Why aren't we scaling? And what can we do? This is shared by many other people, so it's not unique to me. And I've seen some colleagues who I've worked with in the past who have done great work in Africa, making a difference, but struggling to scale. So what are some key insights from the research? The first is that scaling and the scaling challenge is not unique to Africa, like the professor said. Every single country has a scaling problem. Every single continent has a scaling problem. But there are some unique challenges, which when I interviewed people who have invested in social innovations in Africa and in Latin America and in Europe, they said, well, we can only compare the African continent to South Asia in terms of the challenges around scaling. But that there are some unique things in the African context that are even more difficult. The first is the lack of credible data. And I'm sure any of you who have tried to do any concept notes or any strategic plan using data from the continent will realize how many holes you have and how you have to extrapolate based on and make so many assumptions. But data is a huge barrier. And when you try to scale, you need data because you need a baseline from which to work. So data is critical. The second is the heterogeneity of many of our countries. Nigeria is a classic example. Well, when you're trying to scale, you're not just dealing with 350 ethnic groups, over 400 distinct languages with no overlap between the languages, multiple religions, but you're also dealing with multiple layers of rulership. So it's not just the local government chairman. What about the chief, the traditional ruler, the imam? So if you want to scale something around, you know, gender equity, you find that it's actually not government policy that changes things, but actually the faith-based organizations and the traditional rulers at the bottom of the pyramid. Similarly, the fragmented ecosystems. I work a lot in agriculture. And if you have a great seed, great innovation around seeds, how do you actually scale that when every farmer is in their own isolated plot working on less than 1 hectare? You cannot reach thousands and millions of farmers unless you put them in clusters. So that fragmented ecosystem in agriculture and education and health really limits our scaling. And finally, we have significant talent, infrastructure, and financing gaps. And this definitely affects our ability to scale. Now, I want to say up front, and this came up at Oxford, I'll say it, not every social innovation should be scaled. Not every social innovation. Some social innovations are not scalable. They should just remain as state-of-the-art models or centers of excellence. And many of you have heard of Ashesi University. It's a great university in Ghana. And when Patrick Awa started Ashesi University and was doing so well, I sent him an email, I'd like to start Ashesi in Nigeria. He said, no, I have no interest in having Ashesis all over Africa. I want to build a state-of-the-art, world-class university. And that can serve as an example. So I want to put it out there because it's important that we recognize that there's some ideas that stay as great examples for us to see what excellence looks like, but they don't have to scale. Now, what are some prerequisites for scaling? And this is not rocket science, but what struck me was that as I interviewed people and asked them what they required for scaling, it sounded very similar to what you'd learn in business school, right? You need at the bottom a very clear mission, and at the top, a very clear vision. But what is different is that you have to have a very clear vision for what scaling looks like at when it's successful. So when will you know that you have scaled? As the person who's starting the initiative or supporting the development of the initiative, what does it look like when it's scaled? And I think enough of us go in because we want to solve a problem, but we don't actually say, when would I know that I've arrived? Similarly, we have to have very clear values, a clear structure, meaning are we going to be a for-profit model, non-profit, hybrid? Are we going to be embedded in the public sector? Are we going to be embedded in a private sector organization? The pathways to scale, are we going to scale by franchising? Are we going to scale by just increasing our presence in many, many countries? Are we going to scale by changing mindsets, shaping policy? What is the pathway? And then what is the business model? And then finally, the three building blocks: talent and leadership, financing for scaling, and partnerships. And I love this quote by Nelson Mandela, which says, vision without action is just a dream. Action without vision just passes the time. And vision with action can change the world. And the truth is, we're not short of vision in Africa. Every single African has a vision. The issue is action and vision, combining them is often a challenge. The second piece is around the models that scale. And I have a whole chapter devoted to business models that scale. And this, for me, was a big revelation. Because I realized, I realized that many of us take for granted the concept of having a demand-driven business model. So you come up with a great idea because you see a need. It doesn't mean that other people see that need, and it doesn't mean they're willing to pay for it or even fight to get that need, to fill that need. When we started Ace Foods, our first product were going to be jams, because 40 to 60% of our fruits and vegetables go to waste. When you look at the evolution of food processing, you often start with canning or, you know, great. So I had this great idea, mango jam, pineapple jam, papaya jam, guava jam, and we won a business plan competition. That was year one. We produced these jams, Nigerians said, they're not red. We want strawberry jam. But we don't grow strawberries in Nigeria. Maybe in one part of Nigeria called Jos. So who are you catering to 0.05% of the population? By the time we realized what it would take to have red jam, it was going to be watermelon jam, really with food coloring and lots of sugar, then it defeats the purpose of sorting out the 40 to 60% of our fruits and vegetables going to waste, right? Because most of the jam that we found that was sold in Nigeria was actually not jam. It was just flavored water. So the point is, you can come up with a very great innovation, but if it's not demand-driven, it will fail. And we see this in agriculture all the time. I don't know how many of you have heard of the orange flesh sweet potato. So I work a lot in the space, and orange flesh sweet potato is great. It has vitamin A. There's a huge vitamin A deficiency. But people don't want to eat orange flesh sweet potato. When they think of sweet potato, they think of white potato. So you've developed it, you've spent millions of dollars, and now you cannot get people to adopt it. It has to be demand-driven. And that issue around vision for scaling has to drive whether it's demand-driven or not. Second is measurable impact. And the days are gone when you can tell a few good stories about how your intervention has changed lives. People want to see data. Data that's sustainable over time. The intervention has to be simple. If you can't explain it in a sentence, please look at your intervention again. If you need an hour to tell us how you're bringing social change, then it's too complex, and as you try to scale, it's not going to be able to be repeated. How does the intervention engage the community from day one? Does the community own it? Do they see it as an outside intervention? How does this intervention leverage technology? I'll talk more about this. And the most important one, apart from demand, is cost. When we think about the cost to deliver impact per beneficiary, is it prohibitive? Is it sustainable? And I love to use this example, which many of you have heard about in the space, the play pumps. How many of you have heard about the play pumps? So in 2006, I went to the World Economic Forum. Play pumps were celebrated as the next greatest thing to solve the water challenges in Africa. Stephen Case invested in it. He's the founder of AOL. Laura Bush endorsed it. And the vision for the play pump was that children would play around a merry-go-round, and it would pump water into this reservoir, and it would change their lives forever. They wouldn't have to work for 2 hours to bring water, etc. And Coca-Cola and P&G could advertise on this reservoir, so there are multiple streams of income. But guess what? As they tried to scale, they realized that children have to play for 26 hours to pump enough water for this reservoir to be full to supply the village, and that each play pump cost $10,000. So that wasn't sustainable when a borehole cost $2,000 to $3,000, and that when the play pond broke, the villagers couldn't fix it. The truth is, we could laugh about the play pond. People have written about the play pond, but how many of our interventions are play ponds? Lots and lots. I happen to work with a lot of organizations, USAID, DFID, Gates, and if you look at the cost per beneficiary for the intervention, you realize that when the donor funding ends, that project is going to end. Because it's just too expensive. It's not sustainable. People can't pay for it because it focuses on a pilot. The pilot is celebrated. When it comes to scaling, they see some moderate success. When it comes to sustainability, that's when it ends. So it's really critical that we think about the ideal structure for our organizations. And for many organizations that are scaling, what we're finding is that they actually have a hybrid model. So there are components of their business model that are non-profit, there are components that are for-profit, and they can actually create two entities, and they can coexist. And that's what we see, because you cannot justify as a for-profit spending lots of money training or investing in infrastructure to get your operations up and going. Well, donors can fund that. There are aspects of your business model that are self-sustaining, and you should hold yourself to the rigors of a private company. I've talked about having strong data, having a baseline, and then having a comparison group so that you can actually ensure that you have strong results and that you can actually communicate your strategy. And then simplicity of systems and zero room for error, putting in place systems and structures to ensure that your model can be shared, adopted, replicated, or even franchised. A lot of you have heard of the One Acre Fund, and when I was writing this book, I did not focus on any organization as an example of excellence, so I want to put it out there. But I use each organization to demonstrate one aspect of what they're doing that's noteworthy. And for One Acre Fund, I love their focus on M&E. I love that they project their impact beyond the current year. Many of us look at impact and we look, you know, what happened last year? How much impact did we have? They look forward and say, in 2016, 2017, 2018, what impact will we have? That's compelling, because funders love it. They love both private equity, they love to see it. Impact investors, they want to see that. But many of us like to tell stories after the fact. We're not rigorous enough about how we publicize our impact and how we ensure sustainability. And they have scaled very rapidly. They currently are projecting that by 2017, they're going to be serving 520,000 farmers. And they're going to have 5,500 employees. Now, this is bigger than many companies that are operating on the African continent. Beyond the business model for scaling, I have a whole chapter on talent for scaling. And talent is a huge problem that many social innovators have. For those who are scaling, what I recognized is that they were able to attract mission-driven high achievers. Now, mission-driven, which means that they might be willing to take less of a salary, but they have to be high achievers. And how are they able to do this? By building a culture that's attractive, an innovative culture, by ensuring that they have a strong brand, engaging their employees in different roles and responsibilities, investing in training, giving equity where possible, using technology, having strong boards so it's not tied to one person, and having a very clear succession plan from the beginning. The third chapter is focused on financing scaling. And the key takeaway from this one was that there's more money chasing projects in Africa than there are good bankable projects. And this was shocking because most social innovators say, I can't scale because I can't find money. Well, when I talked to everybody who funds social innovators, they said the opposite. We can't find the projects. So there's a supply and demand issue. But the second thing is that there's actually limited awareness about where good opportunities lie and where they're working. The first article I wrote on this topic was called Creating a Level Playing Field, because a lot of the organizations I was finding that were scaling were Europeans or Americans who had come to Africa and were setting up organizations that were scaling. One Acre Fund is started by an American, Asian and American. Bridge International Academies, Americans, right? So a lot of these organizations that are getting lots of funding, and they're donor darlings. All the donors love them, all the donors are funding them. So where are the African-owned, African-created organizations, and why are they getting funding? The honest truth is that many of these organizations are not investment ready, and I can say that because I come from there, I know them, I work with them, and maybe some of the organizations that I've started were also not investment ready. Now, what does it take to be investment ready? Strong financial systems and controls, a very clear communication strategy where you are at the front sharing your stories and making sure those stories get into the public domain. Strong governance structures, strong business models, and a capable and cohesive team. Nobody wants to invest in an individual, they want to invest in a team. My friend Ali Khan is here, and he'll tell you private equity is the same thing. I haven't seen him in many, many years. How cool! All right, partnerships or scaling. There's a whole chapter on partnerships or scaling, and this is really, really important because we cannot scale working in isolation. There's no intervention that has scaled working by itself. You need to partner with the public sector, private sector, and civil society. The first step is to assess your landscape. Really understand the political and regulatory environment, the influence that the government has. Are they key champions in the public sector? What's the life cycle of that government? Are they niches or entry points? And what are the policies and regulations that govern that sector? It's also really important to understand the infrastructure and geography and the culture and social fabric. Once you've understood it, the next step is to shape the ecosystem. And I'll just mention that many of the organizations I talk to say, you know what, we don't like to work with government. Government is too difficult. They hold us back. But when I presented this work in Nigeria, and I said, my dream is that Leap Africa's curriculum will be adopted by the Nigerian government. That's what scaling looks to me like. Somebody stood up, she said, I work with the Ministry of Education, and I'll never support your scaling. I said, why? And she said, because you didn't invite us in the beginning. Leap is 14 years old now, you want to partner with us? And we didn't partner with them because we thought they were going to slow us down. You know, we tried, but their wahala was too much. So the truth is, if that's what scaling looks to you like, you have to start from the beginning. So build a constituency, form strategic partnerships, and either align or cooperate with the government. Now, there are some spaces where you actually have to circumvent the government. And I know some folks working in human rights and LGBT rights, a lot of really hot topics, need to circumvent the government, at least some of our governments, in terms of their social innovations. And then finally, really thinking through how you engage with the other private sector organizations or CSOs. And this map really helps, because when you think about scaling, many of us think about our direct and indirect beneficiaries. I'm sure you guys know that term in this space. And our champions and allies. But we don't often think about our opponents. And this is a blind side for us. We're blindsided by not reflecting our opponents. When we think, I use the example of those working in off-grid energy solutions. Who do you think the opponents for off-grid energy solutions are? Huh? Oil and gas companies. Who else? So, the government that provides, who else? Okay, what about when we're thinking about providing solar as an option, renewable energy? Huh? Eco-friendly green. But then, in my context where I live, it's the generator companies. So the generator companies actually block efficient electricity distribution and innovation in electricity. Because they've made a killing selling us generators, and then diesel companies have made a killing selling us diesel. So they actually block it. But many of us come in with great ideas, off-grid solutions, wow. But then you don't think about who is this hurts, who will be put out of business, or who will be affected. Leadership training is a great thing. Teaching young people ethics and helping them become change agents is wonderful. But I'll tell you that in some Nigerian states, we've come in with funding and said, we want to teach your teachers how to deliver our curriculum. And they've said, no. We don't want young people who are going to challenge us and demand their rights and hold us accountable for, proper elections. So they actually will block you from effectively delivering that. And you're wondering why. But we don't think enough about it. And one example that has scaled in Nigeria is Action Health Incorporated. It was started by this couple, Dr. and Mrs. Eshet, in 1989. And they started just setting up school health clubs in schools around Lagos State because they saw really high rates of HIV spreading in the country, women, young girls getting pregnant or abused. So they developed a curriculum, And then they try to get the government to adopt this curriculum. So public schools to utilize this curriculum. And guess who the number one opponents to this was? The Christian mothers. The Christian mothers. And the PEMSEC, the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Education, was a Christian mother, Catholic Christian mother, and a leader. She did not want this curriculum being taught to, you know, ninth grade, eighth grade students. So she blocked it. So for 2 years, they worked with her and worked on her to educate her. Eventually, she became a champion. This curriculum was then adopted in Lagos State and eventually adopted across the country. And today, it's actually one of the best curricula we have on sexuality and reproductive health. But it takes time. It took them 10 years to scale this. So you have to be patient, you have to be dogged, you have to be committed, and you have to have tenacity. Another example we all celebrate is M-Pesa. And M-Pesa also had dimensions of all of what we've spoken about. The innovation was filling a gap, it was filling a need. People in Kenya were already sending airtime to each other as a way to monetize, to send money across the board. So there was a need, there was a gap. They had the right partners. Diffin started this, but instead of saying, let's bring a UK organization and set them up in Kenya and help them scale, they said, who already has a presence there? Vodafone through Safaricom, let's work with them. They already have agents across the country. Why reinvent the wheel? And that's the importance of partnerships that I talked about. They also realized, and when they did their mapping, they realized there's no policy environment already, so we can shape it. So they worked with a whole range of sex stakeholders to come up with an effective policy environment and the policy and regulations for mobile money transfers. And in 2015, M-Pesa had reached 19.6 million people, 70% of the households in Kenya, over 50% of the poor and unbanked. And when I did this work, and I was asking everybody, what's so unique about Kenya? Why is it that all the models I'm hearing about are in Kenya? They said M-Pesa. So a simple payment system transformed the landscape and created a phenomenal ecosystem. Where there were 15 funders, now there are 75 in Kenya, in Nairobi. You don't have that in any other African city. And the amount of innovation that's coming out of that country is phenomenal. So it's created innovation around energy, savings, loans, healthcare, education, etc. Now they've tried to replicate M-Pesa in Tanzania, in South Africa, in Afghanistan, and India with differing levels of success. Even in Nigeria, we have PAGA. The last check, maybe 3.5 million people. Why hasn't it grown as fast as M-Pesa? It's because you can't just take what has worked in one country and replicate in another. You have to understand the need and the demands in that country, the latent needs in the region. There are also a lot of approaches to scaling in education. I just want to mention that some organizations have built in scaling into their DNA. Bridge International Academies says that it will break even at 500,000 students. So that's its break-even point, 500,000 students. How many of us know what our break-even point is when it comes to social innovation? Replication is the teach for all, teach for America model. When they come into Africa, in every city, it's a new board, it's a new composition, it's a new idea. Pioneer Academies is a great institution out of South Africa that's scaling. They've started with 5 schools, they want to be 100 schools, they want to have 100 schools. So they have different models. Ikamva Youth is another great example from South Africa where it's a peer-led model. And they have been able to show impact by using a control sample of students in schools and comparing their own approach and the impact of their interventions on the lives of their learners. Now, their learners become trainers. So you pay forward whatever you've gained. So I'm going to end by saying the bulk of the book and the bulk of the research focuses on the need for social innovators themselves. stakeholders. I would love to see a continent where the government is actually actively looking for social innovators and supporting their scaling efforts. Obama did it when he assumed presidency in the US. He actually created a desk at the White House where focused on social innovation, looking for social innovations across the United States and enabling them to scale. We need something similar in every ministry, because I think a lot of our governments try to reinvent the wheel without recognizing that there are already great models that are working that just need support. So creating an enabling environment, creating a supportive tax regime that enables, that compels HNIs to actually invest. And one of the things I've been involved in for the last 8 months is the Africa Philanthropy Forum, getting high net worth individuals to give money to African social innovations, because a lot of us are still very dependent on funding from abroad. So that's one of the things that we are seeing a lot of promise emerge from African HNIs who want to give. There's also an active role for private sector. I think within private sector organizations, innovation can be fostered and supported and scaled. But there's also a need for more impact funds and catalytic funds. A company like Danone has done some very interesting work around fostering social innovation. And I think more African companies need to think about that. Development partners, I have a big issue around how development partners work in Africa. But I think one of the key issues is around building local capacity and working with more local organizations that have proven models that scale instead of bringing in what has worked in the US and trying to impose it in the African context. And clearly, academia has an important role to play around research, around incorporating broad-based entrepreneurship and STEAM education, etc. Now, the biggest takeaway for me was obviously that I had to look at the organizations I had started and figure out how to change the business models to enable them to scale. So with LEAP, we went from 13 initiatives to 3. Recognizing that not all initiatives are scalable, some were too expensive, the cost beneficiary was too high, and that with some of our interventions, other people were better suited at delivering them than we were. And I think for us, and every social innovator in this room has to really do an honest self-assessment and a critical evaluation of the interventions. So not all of them are. So we've narrowed our programs to Youth LEAP, Business LEAP, and E-LEAP. And with our E-LEAP, we've been teaching ethics for about 14 years. When we started teaching ethics, it was actually the British High Commissioner at the time, Richard Gosling, who read an article I had written, which the title of the article was, "Are Nigerians Poor Corrupt Because They're Poor or Poor Because They're Corrupt?" So he called me up and said, "I want to hear more about what you want to do about this." So we started an integrity institute, and we had trained thousands of people, but we hadn't reached the critical mass we needed. So we've now captured a one-week ethics program into a one-hour e-learning course. Definitely a different type of impact, but a test at the beginning, a test at the end, games throughout, which allows you to collect data on how people think and allows you to also track and stay in touch with them after they finish the course. We hope to develop more e-learning curriculum that's very practical and learning. It's not working. So my personal dream as I round up is that we'll work ourselves out of jobs. I get very frustrated when I meet people, and with all due respect to everybody who's worked in development for 30 years, I get very upset when I meet people and I say, "We've been doing this for 30 years, the same thing." I think we will continue to solve social problems, so we should try to move on to new problems and work ourselves out of the jobs that we currently have. The frustration is that we can't, 10 years from now, be telling the same stories we're telling about Africa. I don't think our children will, I mean, our children will hold us accountable for what we did not do to transform our continent. And I love this quote by Bill Drayton, which says, "Social entrepreneurs are not content just to give a fish or teach how to fish. They will not rest until they have revolutionized the fishing industry." And I think social innovators have to be catalytic enough to transform the landscape in which they work and to move on to new problems. And my favorite quote says, "If you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go with others." I think in this space, it's time we start collaborating across the board. That's why I'm delighted that LSE has given me this platform to share some of the insights from the book. There's a lot more in the book, so I would encourage you to get a copy. In Nigeria, it's much cheaper. We have rights to Nigeria, so in Nigeria, it's called, name of the book in Nigeria is called Reaching Millions with Impact. And it's like $5 or less. But here, obviously, Routledge is the publisher and they set the price. But please think about your own work and how you can become more engaged with solving some of the social problems on the African continent, working in collaboration with others, and ensuring that we make the most impact on the lives of people, so that we don't have repeats of the seven-year-old. Because honestly, humanity will hold us accountable for what we choose to do and what we ignore. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Didi, for this wonderful speech. Sorry for the technology, also to the audience, for the cracks in the system. Maybe one comment to start with. When you read the book, a lot of the advice sounds almost obvious, very practical, until you realize that if you look at actual social enterprises out there, 8 out of 10 are not doing it. Yeah? So all these insights are actually extremely useful for anyone who's starting this, who's starting his own, or is even experienced a social entrepreneur. Because the sort of knowledge that you get in writing this book, you only get after having seen tens of social enterprises up close. So probably everyone can learn. Maybe to drive home in another way why this is interesting. It's my privilege to ask a couple of questions before I give it to the audience. Views of power or whatever you would like. So I have three questions, maybe with A's and B's. And one.
Can you guys hear us?
Yeah.
Yes.
Maybe it's necessary for the recording, or looking at the...
Yes, we need it for the recording, please.
Okay,
so please bear with us in the... correct. So it's my pleasure to ask three questions, maybe with A's and B's. My first question... is around. First question would be around why it's so difficult, or why do we see so few social enterprises scaling up? What is keeping, if it's so obvious to do it, but why do we see so few? And let me share one very little anecdote, and then I give the floor to you. To tap into your knowledge. I remember.
Turn it off, I found the problem.
I think you shared that.
It's a loose wire.
So Carsten is currently close to a loose wire. Carsten, would you like to stay there?
I think we need a social entrepreneur to solve Edison's audiovisual problem.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, I can't access it, so if it can't be too bad, we're just going to switch it off.
Okay.
Thank you. So why do we see so... and to share the little anecdote, I remember giving a workshop a couple of years ago at Senkal, which is a forum for investors and social entrepreneurs in India. And these were prize-winning social entrepreneurs, so they were among the best in their class. And I noticed that of the 10 social entrepreneurs or groups, none of them was working with partners. And so, to drive the point home, I sent them away for 50 minutes, and I gave them the assignment, come back in 50 minutes, and tell me how 1 year from now you want to be 10 times as large. So they talk about partners. So then they're sort of forced to come up with the idea, hey, maybe we need partners for distribution or manufacturing or whatever. So the point is, even prize-winning social entrepreneurs have the cognitive barrier or the cognitive bias, if you like. I can do things that's my own. So apparently one reason why so few scale up is this cognitive bias. I'm doing this 24/7. I'm giving my best, I should do. So tapping into your wisdom, what sort of internal barriers or biases or problems do you see that social entrepreneurs need to overcome? And once maybe if they understand the problem, it will be easier to scale up. What sort of problems, what sort of barriers do you see for scaling up? Why do you see so few?
Scaling, yeah. No, I think it's a very important question. And I'll say there are three main reasons. The first one you've just addressed, which is the issue of egos and logos. Mm-hmm. Egos and logos. I mean, so many of us come to this because we believe we want to make a change and we believe we have the solution. And we don't want to share the rewards, the emotional benefits with others. And I always interrogate, I would challenge the social entrepreneurs, and I still do. Why are you doing this? If it's really to solve a social problem, then you shouldn't care who gets the credit, provided that that problem is solved. So egos and logos, you hit it right on the head. We don't want a partner. And across the board, I'll give you an example. Recently, we convened all these high net worth individuals in Lagos. And when we went around the room, half of them were giving scholarships. Half. It's great, they're giving. They're giving scholarships. But can't they come together and pool their resources to solve some of the most pressing problems around education? It's not working. If we don't have a good
business. thinking about how to come into that space with a social innovation to solve the skill gap problem. So I'm optimistic that we can solve it.
Okay. Thank you for that. Another question. One thing you mentioned is impact, right? And you said, well, impact is very important, with accountability and so on. That's no longer a soft story, but you need harder information. My question is around, is there a downside to this as well? Your book is more sophisticated than a lot of management stuff. In the sense that it starts with a theory of change. So you need to understand.
Yeah. They are very, very strategic about how they collect information, and they create incentives for everybody to provide that information along the chain. Because as you grow bigger, you're not going to be in every location. For those who provide direct training and direct service, you're not going to be able to be in every branch or every outlet of your service provision. And just like the private sector has developed, I mean, banks have scaled in many African countries. How do they measure impact? They have connected databases and systems. They have ways to check fraud. I think we have to infuse many of those systems and structures into the social space as well. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to demonstrate the impact that we make. So that would be my response. We're still working in progress, but that's why data is so critical. We still need our governments to also have good baselines that we can work with. Recently, I mentioned the 37% stunting rate that we have in Nigeria at the moment. So a lot of state governments are saying, yeah, we have 3 million people in IDP camps, but we're starting to resettle them. And just 2 days ago, MSN came out and said, no, they're not resettling them, the numbers are growing. They're going to be, you know, 50,000 children are going to die next week if we don't feed them. So who do you trust? The government that's saying that they're resettling the IDP camps or MSN? MSN obviously also has an agenda, right? They need more funding. If they say the situation is worse, they can get more money. The government has an agenda. It wants to show its citizens that it's working on their behalf. The truth must lie somewhere in between. And every African always tries to make, I'll extrapolate. I'll make some assumptions based on the two and competing agendas. I'm going to assume that it's not but I think we really need to hold our governments accountable to give the baseline data we need to solve some of these problems and to know where we're moving the needle. So can we open it up to questions?
Yeah, I was about to suggest. So who has a question?
Okay.
Thanks for speaking to us today. My name is Mune Ganda, I'm an African development student. And my question is about approaching the problem from both ends. So in addition to getting innovators to scale, what are your thoughts on getting those who have scale to innovate? So with the ACE example, what if Dangote's internal strategy team or Unilever's R&D team were thinking about how to use their supply chains to absorb some of those waste fruits and vegetables? What are your thoughts on?
I definitely think we need scaling in at both levels. I completely agree with you. The only challenge is when the large companies, because they already have the power, kill all of us. So it's interesting. I don't even mention this because you guys are tweeting. When one large company came to us one day and they saw our product, and we have a soya maize that is for addressing moderate malnutrition, and they picked it up and unfortunately, as you can imagine, there are monopolistic tendencies and some are very aggressive in many contexts. But obviously, they haven't killed us yet. So as we're small and nimble, we can innovate even faster. But that's a challenge. The challenge is how do you ensure that there's innovation, but then also the policy environment does not kill off SMEs that are really the bedrock of innovation in many other parts of the world as well. So I think we need both.
Is your concern that they would innovate away the social part of it? Like they would pick up your products and drop?
So I'll use this example. And this particular organization has gone, for example, to the government and to the World Food Program and said, you guys can only source from us. If we're going to invest X amount in this, you can only source from us. So when you have those exclusive relationships and you have the ear of the government, we need large companies to innovate, but we also need policy environment to hold them accountable to be fair. That's all I'm saying. I don't want to go further than that. I want to get home.
Hello. Thank you again for this wonderful presentation. I have a very short question. Are you aware of the Financial Times inaugural philanthropy and social impact summit that they are organizing at the end of this month? Because
I haven't been invited.
Well, I will facilitate that for you because I really feel that they will benefit from your input at this initial stage.
Thank you. Many of us would love to hear about it, so please share it. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah?
When it comes to SME capacity building, which is also a flavor of Labor of the Month. Who do you think are the leaders and why?
I would say every country you have a different set of leaders. In Nigeria, the Enterprise Development Center, who our professor works with, at the forefront of enterprise development, they call the Enterprise Development Center, but they've been doing a lot of interesting work in partnership with others. And for them, their scaling has been through partnerships. And I think they're extremely collaborative, and they utilize best practice based on what other countries are doing and what has been observed in other places. That's in the Nigerian context. In Ghana, you have a mix. GIMPA has tried to innovate. GIMPA is a government agency. Are you from, anybody from Ghana?
Yeah, I don't know.
So GIMPA has tried to innovate. When Prof. Sage was the DG, he did a lot of great work. And so you see a public institution actually stepping up to fill that gap.
Yes.
As opposed to a private sector or a non-profit organization. And so it varies by country. In Kenya, I mean, we're talking about the IHOP there. Is it called IHOP?
Yeah.
The IHOP in Kenya is doing great work. So I would say it varies by country. In South Africa, Gibbs is really pushing a little Gordon Institute. Have you guys heard of Gibbs? And so in every country, it's a different institution. And the key to their success is in partnerships. SME development is not easy, it's time intensive, it's costly if you do it, you know, one on one versus using a lot of e-learning technology as a partnership.
Even before we started, we've been having people wanting to invest in us.
Now, the challenge is meeting someone like you gives a new dimension to the thinking. And we've just been knocked back about 6 weeks by NHS giving us some data. The first question is, do you do personal, do you do consulting for startups looking to go into the social innovation space?
No, I don't. Well, I'll give some of my time. Right now, my consulting work is in agriculture and nutrition. But I'll be happy to connect you with all the health people I know and to give you some general support.
Okay, that's the first question. Thank you. The second thing is that I think in the area of innovation, I took a course in disruptive innovation with Clayton Christensen. And one of the things I've learned is that you need to segment your innovation, because if you go into certain forms of innovation, the big players will come and kill you. So you need to sort of look at new market innovation or disruptive innovation where they think, oh, it'll be just a nuisance. And by the time you creep up, you're a big player. WhatsApp is a good example. So basically, one of the models we're kind of looking at is doing that, and we're not trying to knock out the healthcare players, and we're not trying to wipe out what the government is doing. So it would be good to be able to have some conversation with you.
Definitely. I'm really excited about what you're trying to do.
And I think the last thing I wanted to sort of talk about is basically in terms of engaging with social innovators, we are creating an ecospace called Innovate Africa. And I think Leap Africa, what you're doing, is quite good. And we're looking to have the first summit in Abuja and then in Kigali 2 years after that. So it'd be good to talk to you. So it's the kind of thing now, I've been looking for people in the same space. But one of the challenges if you're on LinkedIn is that there's so many experts and you don't know who is.
Thank you. Well, you're doing exciting work. And we'll talk offline.
I'm a lawyer, so you wouldn't get any of the social innovation talk, but I was interested in your mango jam example. Yeah. And I wondered whether it is possible to incentivize or create demand. So for instance, I see an emerging, well, I call it celebrity culture in Nigeria and some other things. If you get endorsements and some key influencers eating mango jam, is there the possibility, because can we or is it so difficult to change certain habits?
I would say you can change habits. But I would be selective about how much effort I'm willing to put into changing that habit. If it was a, let's say, FGM, mutilation of kids, girls, or rape, the rape culture. Yes, we have to invest in changing those mindsets. But that same amount of energy to get people to eat mango jam, for me, it doesn't make sense. Instead, introduce dried mangoes. That's a closer lead. You understand that mango jam. So I would say that, and I always tell people, with Leap, we work with so many young people. I say, what makes you angry? And they make a long list. Lots of things that make them angry about the environment. Then you prioritize that list. And then you realize that, obviously, it's some things are easier to solve than others. And then you do the cost-benefit analysis. And you're staying power. Okay, starting a company is hard enough. Building a supply chain is even more difficult in a fragmented system. Then to add changing mindsets to that, you actually give up in 2 years. So our key strategy was going to be spices. So we basically said, you know what? We spent a year trying to sell all these jams and finally coming up with a mixed fruit jam that's red. But doesn't make sense. The other thing I didn't mention was that when we wrote our business plan, sugar was 6,000 naira a bag, and overnight it became 12,000 naira. It's the same issue we just discussed. The monopoly, one company controls about 95% market share of sugar. And so sugar is a big input in jam. And so you realize there are lots of things working against you, but you can't own spices. Now, so we started doing B2B. We started selling, we went to all the blue companies. What spices are
PhD student in management. Do you have an example of a social enterprise that is effectively collaborating with other organizations like care and education? And why do you think it's a successful, this partnership? What are the requirements of this successful?
So one of the successful ones is actually based out of London. It's called Writers for Health. How many of you have heard of Writers for Health? And what's surprising about Writers is that they get African governments to provide 50% of their operating budget. It's incredible. And in the book, I have an example of how Writers got 50% of their budget from, for the work they're going to do in Gambia from the government. And the other 50%, they got a loan from a bank. And this is a non-profit. And the loan was from Guarantee Trust Bank, and the guarantor of the loan was the school foundation. And so it's very interesting. It shows you that there are lots of dimensions around financing that we don't even consider. And so why has Writers been very successful? Number one is that they have a very compelling business case that they make to the government. Their service provision is that they basically work in rural communities providing healthcare delivery systems. So motorcycles, in the hardest to reach places, ambulance services. So they say to the government, instead of you managing all this, you know, infrastructure, all these vehicles and drivers and people, let's outsource this to us. So they service the primary healthcare system, the strong drug distribution, etc. And the government sees it as a partnership. And they've done quite well in many African countries. So they build the trust. And they don't align so closely that when the president is changed, they lose the business. They actually also build relationships with the PEMSEC, the directors of the ministries, the age, the full-time staff, and they build a trusting relationship. So that's one example.
Thanks. I'm Jacinta Schutt, and we're involved with charity. We're looking at the fashion industry specifically in Nigeria. We're looking at social impact around that. So I wanted to ask you what you thought it would take, or if you knew anybody who's already working in cotton growing, what it would take to bring the actual growing and manufacturing side back into Nigeria. I know that's a big question, but do you come across anything that works? Or?
The cotton industry is a very interesting one, and we can talk offline. There are a few initiatives that are going on in the cotton space. The thing is that you're talking about a very long value chain from cotton all the way to the fashion, the finished goods. You're going to have to figure out where in that value chain you have the best opportunity to make impact. I would say, for example, if I was to suggest something, is that I would start with indigenous fabrics. So about 15 years ago, I worked on Ashoka and Amire, which are indigenous fabrics that are made by women in rural communities. And it's extremely labor intensive. These women get next to nothing. And it's a dying skill. And it's so amazing, right? But now, what happens is that Chinese designers come and take pictures, and they replicate it, and they flood the market with the product. And Nigerians love to wear all of the stuff that's imported from China. We don't know where it's coming from when we say, So I would love to see that move, because that's you can make a strong case for the impact you're making a woman who's teaching her daughter a trade. Then it's a shorter, obviously you're gonna have to ensure that you reach thousands and thousands of women, rather than saying I'm gonna go down to the grow. That will now drive the demand for farmers to grow. Do you understand what I'm saying? As opposed to trying to manage the entire value chain. We at least would realize that we weren't gonna cultivate the products we use. But we train farmers, we put them in clusters, we give them microfinance and storage technology, etc. But if we decide to take over the entire value chain, if we stretch too thin, we don't have the competencies, what is that focus? Do you understand? So you have to really map out your value chain and determine where you can add the next value. Is that clear?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So can I just quickly say something?
Okay.
The one partner of mine, Theo Mangala, the former model, she actually has a company called Ubuntu, which really tries to make people live off their products in Africa based on fashion. So I think she's based here in London, but she works a lot in Nigeria because she is Nigerian. So I'm happy to connect you.
Fantastic, thank you. And I know there's lots of work in Mali to connect you to those.
I'm more interested.
developing the new Masters in Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship in the Department of Math, right? And my question is really about a lot of the sort of talk in the town now is about social impact investing. In fact, I have a student who's starting a social impact investing movement in LSE. I've met with Barclays and some other companies who are actually developing social impact funds. But I'm wondering if that will ever really trickle down to real social innovators, or is it just the M-Pesas and the obvious ones who already have high returns on investment or reasonable returns on investment? And also, if you think this is just a trend that's going to die a beautiful death in 5 years, because as I said, everybody I'm meeting in the last few weeks is talking about social, from large corporations to even my students. So I love your view on social impact.
Yeah, I hope it doesn't die. But I agree with you that it's a trend now. What I would say is that there's work to be done on both ends. There's a lot of work to be done in building the capacity of local organizations to absorb the capital and to communicate the impact. And there's also work on the social impact investment side to find those groups. And I think partnering with Ford, Ashoka, Leap, all the organizations that are giving social innovation awards is really important. Now, we also need smaller size funds. So there's a lot of money around the $1 billion and there's money around the $25,000 man. But between $25,000 and $1 million, you need smaller tranches of funding. Acumen and others are providing some funding, but they still fall on the base around those organizations that we know that are very good at policy. So we every year we recognize 20 social innovators, and we partner with a local bank, Union Bank, and it gives small amounts of money. But what we also do is we amplify their work. And recently, Mark Zuckerberg invested in one of them. And what he's doing is using mobile telephones to provide healthcare information to pregnant women. And he's gone to all these primary healthcare centers and signed up thousands of women to get healthcare information. And he's tracking, obviously, the number of women versus the control group, those who are successful births and healthy children, etc. But it's generating so much excitement because there's also an income stream, right, around the type of drugs you should be taking, what information you're providing around medicine, linkages to healthcare providers, etc. But these young people have great ideas, but nobody is amplifying the work they're doing and sharing it across. I would say that what you need to challenge your. I mentioned in Kenya there were 15 impact funds, now there are 75. And they can't find enough groups to fund. What we need to do is to bridge that knowledge gap and to bridge that capacity gap. Yeah?
Sorry, very quick question. Where in Nigeria is your book stopped? Where in Nigeria is your book stopped?
My good stuff.
Your book.
So my book is sold at Latana.
Okay.
It's also Jumia, sold in Jumia and at Leap's office. Yes, so you can find it.
Also Amazon, actually.
Amazon has the
British
version.
How much is the British
one? £20.